Hey friends, if you live in or around Washington, D.C., we wanted to let you know about an exciting event hosted by our own Linda Holmes. This Saturday at 7:30 p.m., NPR presents an exclusive panel with the stars from Amazon's new show, Good Girls Revolt. Join us at the Newseum for lively discussion of journalism, politics, and the arts with stars Anna Camp, Joy Bryant, Aaron Drake, and Genevieve Angelson, plus Congresswoman Eleanor Holmes Norton and journalist Lynn Povich. Tickets are going fast, so get yours now at nprpresents.org.
Welcome to Pop Culture Happy Hour, NPR's roundtable podcast about movies, TV, music, books, and more. I'm Stephen Thompson. I'm a writer and editor with NPR Music. And on this week's show, we'll discuss two new movies, one massive blockbuster and one you'll be hearing about more during Oscar season. And as we do on every episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour, we'll close the show with what's making us happy this week, so stick around.
Take Pop Culture Happy Hour and other NPR content with you all the time with the NPR One app. NPR One finds you the best from public radio and beyond. Songs we love, local stories, and your favorite podcasts. NPR One makes driving, working, or cleaning the house better. Find NPR One in your app store.
We've got Doctor Strange and Moonlight on the docket for today, but before we get started here in not-so-historic Studio 46, let's go around the table. Glenn Weldon, what do you do at NPR?
I write about books and comic books and other stuff for the NPR website.
Kat Chow!
Woo, woo.
Oh, so good to have you back. What do you do at NPR?
I'm a reporter with Code Switch.
And Gene Demby, how about you, buddy? What do you do at NPR?
I'm a blogger and the co-host of the Code Switch podcast.
Yep.
Excellent. Well, it's good to have you all here. Before we begin, we wanted to welcome new listeners who may have found us through the NPR Politics podcast or on NPR One. Welcome! Now, speaking of politics, we are recording this show on Monday, November 7th. We know this is a big week for news, and even though we were never going to talk about the election anyway under any circumstances, we did want to give you a heads up. Okay, so moving on. The weekend's big blockbuster is a long-awaited new entry in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Doctor Strange, starring Benedict Cumberbatch as an arrogant brain surgeon who gets in a terrible car accident and winds up becoming an extremely powerful sorcerer because that's how it goes sometimes. In this case, he is trying to fix his badly damaged hands, so he goes to Nepal where he meets sorcerers, played by Chiwetel Ejiofor and Benedict Wong, and studies under the Ancient One, played by Tilda Swinton. Glenn, I'm going to start with you because you are our go-to expert on comic books and comic book movies. How did you like Doctor Strange?
I was surprised that it works as well as it does, and I do think it works. I did not see it in 3D. Every critic is urging you to see it in 3D. This is one movie you need to see in 3D. I saw it in 2B. I went to a Alamo Drafthouse and had a couple Guinnesses, and it turns out that's also pretty good. Guinness, I suppose. It is visually spectacular in ways that struck me as novel. I mean, yes, there's a lot of echoes of Inception in this, but it's stuff you haven't really seen before. I own a lot of the early Doctor Strange comics, or at least reprints of them, with art and story by Steve Ditko and script by Stan Lee. And reading those things, you never know what the hell's going on, but it looks great because it's Steve Ditko. And this really captured that feeling for me. And the reason I'm surprised that it worked at all is because whenever something visually B-A-N-A-N-A-S is about to go happen, they go out of their way to enter what's called the mirror dimension. And I think this is an actual line in the script. What happens in here does not affect the real world at all.
What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
It's like A, meta, and B, a little on the nose there, movie.
Right.
Because so if nothing matters, what's the point except it looks cool? And yet I still dug it.
All right, Gene, what did you think of Doctor Strange?
It was stunning to look at, even though it hit a lot of those familiar Marvel beats. I mean, you know, we know this is the cocky guy who has to, like, you know, find his purpose in life. You know, it was sort of Magic House in a lot of ways. He's like this arrogant doctor who has to, like, you know, save the world. You know? But the first, like, literally the first 30 minutes feel like an episode of House. It was like, I mean.
Oh, my God. And he did seem sort of Hugh Laurie-ish.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Down to the hard R's in the accent.
Yes. There were some accent issues, I thought.
American-English accent work. And Benedict Cumberbatch is really good in it. A lot of the sort of supernatural hokum, which is like a place where these movies often go off the rails.
Yeah.
It just breezes by really quickly, so you're not sticking with it long enough to be like, okay, that's stupid. Like, no one is like lingering on it long enough for you to realize how ridiculous it sounds. I was surprised at how much it worked because Marvel movies at this point are sort of like, it's like sort of trying to take in an individual game in a baseball season. You're like, this thing does not matter. Like, it only sort of matters in the aggregate at this point. What is this Marvel movie number? 14, 15?
300,000.
Right. Yeah. And this is still building to, I mean, there's a, you know, this is one of the things the movie does really well is like, you sort of don't feel the gravity of the Marvel Cinematic Universe like weighing on it,
right.
Except for in a few scenes where, you know, someone now sees the Infinity Stone, like, oh, this is setting up, you know, the coming. There's a scene at the end, one of the post-credit scenes that's sort of like...
Yeah, that sort of sets the movie's place in the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
But it doesn't feel like you need to have like all the backstory to come into this movie to watch it. It actually sort of stands alone, which is impressive in and of itself, considering how deep into the Marvel canon we are at this point.
Yeah, and I actually liked that about it. Anytime they sort of hinted at its place in a larger Marvel universe, I just immediately forget my place.
Right.
and so as soon as they start to weave in like reminders of where it might fit, I'm like, I'm out. All right, Kat, you've been sitting here. You've actually just like teetering on the brink of your chair.
I actually am. I wish that the listeners could see me right now. I had a lot of trouble with this one because I wasn't going to watch it because earlier this year, there was a lot of controversy around the casting of Tilda Swinton as the Ancient One, where the Ancient One, the character, was originally Tibetan. And to a lot of people, this just seemed like another instance of an Asian character's role getting completely whitewashed.
Right.
And it didn't help that Robert Cargill, he's the screenwriter, he basically said that the Ancient One was this racist stereotype, and he also originates from Tibet. Bet is the quote. And they didn't want to risk alienating a billion people from China who could potentially watching it. Yeah. So I had all of this in my mind as I was watching it. And I kept thinking, this is like the opposite of rep sweats, where I have like rep hate, rep animosity, where I just don't know if I'm going to be able to enjoy this movie for what it is. And I did think it was stunning. But to me, it felt like Tilda Swinton is, again, like Scarlett Johansson in Ghost in the Shell or Emma Stone in Aloha. Mm-hmm. Can't really get over that.
So the fact that they put a white actor in a role that, by all logic, should be played by an Asian person.
Right.
Yeah, but let's question that logic, okay? Because the comic that was made in 1963 does lean hard into the kind of lazy orientalism that a lot of Western literature does, where the East is this mystic place. The West is a place of logic and...
And science.
And science and rules of propriety. Mm-hmm. The white guy goes off to the East to get transcendental, to get insight. and this is Ian Porter. This is Somerset Maugham. You could argue this is even Hermann Hesse. By the way, this hero is not... by any means, the first hero to kind of be a white guy going off to the mysterious East.
The mysterious East.
The Shadow did it originally. If you consider the Shadow the first superhero, then it comes from there. His ability to cloud men's minds comes from his travels in the East. You know, you also have Iron Fist. There's going to be a Netflix series where it's the same white guy goes to the East. Bruce Wayne has a little trip through the character of Doctor Strange was based on Shandu the Magician, which was a radio serial that Stan Lee really liked. Same guy, same white guy, American guy goes to the East to learn things. If you think about it for even a second, they could have made a clean break here because the mysticism that this film, all of the Marvel magical heroes and villains occupy or use has nothing to do with any belief practice in any Asian country at all. It is purist mumbo-jumbo. And in fact, it's like he used the Eye of Agamotto, the Book of the Vicente, the Book of the Cagliostro. It's like they could have set this in Sicily.
Right.
Or Hackensack, New Jersey.
Right.
And had like Tilda Swinton playing somebody with a little chef's hat going, "Mwah, it's a good pizza. It's a me, the Ancient One."
But I also do think that there is a way for them to cast Asian American actors in that role without
or just
being
Asian,
or just Asian actors,
with like Michelle Yeo, without being totally Orientalist. And Tilda Swinton did an acceptable job, but I think other people could have also.
The thing about Tibet doesn't make a lot of sense to me because this is clearly set in Nepal, which is not Tibet, and in the actual original comic, the Sanctum, whatever, is in the Himalayas, which technically doesn't cross into Tibet. So, I mean, there's a lot of weird stuff in here, but the mumbo jumbo is the stuff that I eat up with a spoon. I mean, it's like, by the hoary hosts of Hoggoth, by the ruby rings of Radagar. That's the kind of stuff that has nothing to do with anything except that sometimes words sound fun to say.
It's interesting to me that the controversy surrounding the casting of Tilda Swinton is tricky in part because I and so many people love Tilda Swinton so much and want Tilda Swinton to be plopped into as many different movies as possible to kind of Tilda Swinton it up and be weird. And it's tricky on one hand for me to lament the casting of Tilda Swinton in anything. And I also get the argument that the dangers of casting this character as some sort of like mystical dragon lady from the mysterious east. I could just as easily see them falling flat on their face having cast an Asian person in that role.
Sure. And so I think to Glenn's point, they did this weird thing where they sort of like just try to like find the middle ground, which is like, let's put a white person in this role and then just have it have the same backdrop, which is like ridiculous if the argument was we're trying to break away from this racist stereotype.
Right.
They still could have had an Asian American actor or an Asian actor in that role and just set it somewhere else, right? I mean, like to Glenn's point, none of that stuff is like married to, I'm doing air quotes here,
the air quotes.
In the Far East, right? But they didn't do that, right? And so, like, every time she was on the screen, I thought about that, right? Because there are other characters in the movie that are race bent. I mean, Chiwetel Ejiofor's character is not black in the comics. I mean, when directors want them to be sort of incidental to the plot, they just make an argument that they're incidental to the plot. But, I mean, obviously they're not.
But then, Stephen, to your point about potentially wading into sort of like dragon lady or stereotypical characters, Benedict Wong's character, Wong, was, I mean, in the original comics, was more of the servant type
character.
He makes
tea.
He makes tea. And so, I mean, Benedict Wong in the actual movie, he was funny.
He's funny and a badass.
Yeah. Right. He's also Asian.
Right. It's not the Asianness that makes the execution bad, right? Or potentially dangerous. It's the execution, right? I mean, it's the actual execution that matters there.
Yeah, I mean, it seemed to me like so much of this movie was just trying to have its cake and eat it too in as many ways as humanly possible. I mean, you said it yourself, the argument about like, well, we don't want to alienate the audience in China. Like, this movie has made, I think it's made like hundreds of millions of dollars overseas even before it even came out in the U.S.
Wow.
And it's very clearly not unlike actually the Kung Fu Panda movies, kind of going for a fusion of American movie styles and Asian movie styles.
Yeah, and you know, it did have jokes. It did work like that. Dan Harmon, I think, came in to do some punch up on it. Mystical battles are always tough to film because at the end of the day, it's just people grimacing at each other with CGI.
With occasional, like, cracking.
With making the weird hand motions.
Right.
Yep.
So they do things like they make his cloak, the cloak of levitation, they make it a character in a way that is a lot of fun. You know, they could have done this very rote. And, you know, to your point, it's another origin story. Yeah, but, I mean, this isn't like seeing the Waynes get slaughtered again.
Exactly.
Like, who knows Doctor Strange's origin?
I did not know Doctor Strange's origin.
Nobody who came out of this going, oh, that again.
I do want to talk about something else about this movie and the part that I really could not get enough of, and ultimately what made me wholly recommend this movie is just the incredible visuals.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And to me, this film was just exhibit A in why junky CGI is junk. And like, I had gotten to the point where I was starting to blame CGI. I was starting to think, like, CGI has kind of wrecked a lot of action movies because, you know, you see the building get knocked over and you just feel like in so many of these movies, in so many of the superhero movies, in so many of the Star Trek movies, in so many action movies, you could literally swap giant chunks of buildings getting knocked down, use them as stock footage, and plug them into other new movies, and I would not be able to tell that you'd done it.
Uh-huh.
And so much CGI is so generic, and you know, you're sitting there, you're watching, and it's true in this too, like, you can see where the actors are clearly working with green screen, and all the heavy lifting is being done by animators and visual artists and special effects operators, but to me, the visual imagination of this movie really put it a cut above so many movies like it. And in a way, like, I remember when we talked about Ant-Man, I'm watching battle sequences here that are unlike any battle sequences I've ever seen before. I'm just seeing a battle from a completely different perspective in a completely different way, and that's so fun and cool. And I had kind of the same experience with this. Like, instead of seeing buildings get knocked down, you see some buildings get knocked down, but instead of seeing buildings get knocked down, you see cityscapes folding in and buckling on themselves and forming. The aesthetic of this movie, I was trying to put my finger on exactly how to describe it, and I came up with steampunk MC Escher.
That's exactly, yeah. That's great.
I like that.
Like, you are watching these incredibly elaborate, like, hypnotic visual art pieces unfolding in this incredibly kinetic and exciting and beautiful way. Glenn joked earlier about, like, oh my God, you know, everybody's saying, oh, you have to see it in 3D, you have to see it in 3D. I genuinely was glad I saw it in 3D. Mm-hmm. And I think it's the second movie I can say that about after, like, Life of Pi. It is so gorgeous to look at. And there were several points, including some of the stuff where they play around with time a little bit and talk about time paradoxes. I'm just such a sucker for that. Your Edge of Tomorrow / Live, Die, Repeat, you know, like goofing around with manipulating time. I just love that stuff. And yes, tons of it is mumbo jumbo, but I ate it up with a spoon.
Yeah. And especially when we go to the dark dimension, there's a mirror dimension and the dark dimension. And when we get there, it's an actual Steve Ditko panel.
Is it really?
So it's there for nerds like me and it looks fantastic. And so, yeah, it's like little moments like that. I mean, I guess you call them Easter eggs, but it just felt like it was part of a cohesive whole of this universe that Stan Lee was just kind of riffing on, just kind of making stuff up. Just because, you know, it's literally hand-waving. Very literally. Don't worry about this and then have him make some very trippy hand motions.
I'm sure that many people at home will have many thoughts about this movie. Come find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH or on Twitter at PCHH. After the break, we will discuss a movie that cost quite a bit less to make than Doctor Strange, Moonlight. So come right back.
Support for Pop Culture Happy Hour and the following message come from the new original comedy series Search Party on TBS, an official selection at the 2016 South by Southwest Film Festival. Watch the mystery unravel as a lost soul and her group of friends search for a missing girl they barely even knew. You can binge the entire season of Search Party in 1 week, starting Monday, November 21st at 11, 10 Central on TBS.
Welcome back to Pop Culture Happy Hour. November is upon us, which means we are finally, at long last, heading into the awards season for movies. And if there is an early frontrunner, it may well be Moonlight, a coming-of-age film written and directed by Barry Jenkins, based on the play In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue by Terrell Alvin McCraney. The film tells the story of Chiron, a quiet kid who comes from a troubled household in Miami and has to deal with a lot of bullying, in part due to his sexuality. Eventually, we see the man he becomes, but the process is very slow and halting, with a lot left unspoken and unshown over the course of a couple of decades. So the movie is broken down into three roughly equal chapters, in which Chiron is played by three different actors. As a child, he's played by Alex Hibbert. As a teenager, he's played by Ashton Sanders. And as a man, he's played by Trevante Rhodes. Now, I'm going to start with Gene, because I know Gene has thoughts.
Dun, dun, dun.
So I should say up top that I love this movie. I think it's like my favorite movie that I've seen this year. And I had so many feelings after seeing it. But one of the first things I felt was like this sense of dread that it was going to be ruined by this like deluge of think pieces about black masculinity.
Yes. Can you talk about Moonlight's intersexuality vis-a-vis black masculinity?
Oh my gosh.
In a Hobbesian world, can you do that for me, Gene?
I found a few of them and I started reading them off to my girlfriend. Like, let me just like, just the this like bloodless pro, like it's just like the thing about it is like all that stuff is there to be sort of dissected, but also it misses a lot of the point, right? Like so much of this movie is about how it feels, like, because there's not a lot of dialogue in this movie, and it doesn't really have much of a plot. I mean, there's an arc, but like even when we were at Code Switch, we did an interview with Barry Jenkins, who's the director.
That is a great interview.
Oh, thank you so much. Yeah. But one of the things that was hard for us when we did that interview was that there was not a lot of clips to pull out because there isn't a lot of dialogue.
Very quiet.
It's a really quiet movie. A lot of stuff happens on the faces of the characters, and in the scenes in which people are talking, they tend to be pivotal scenes, and so we couldn't like pull the clips because we would be giving so much away. Because so much of it is, and when people ask you like what this movie is about, it's like, it's about how so much of this feels, how suffocating it is, how liberating some of it is. Mm-hmm. There is a conversation to be had at 30,000 feet, you know, using the jargon of the spaces we inhabit, but it actually does a disservice to the art of the film.
Kat, what'd you think?
I thought it was beautiful. I really love Mahershala Ali in it. He's this sort of older mentory role in the movie. Is that how you guys would describe it?
Yeah, like he's an early father figure when Chiron is a kid.
And just seeing him in this role, I mean, I'd seen him recently in Luke Cage and then also in House of Cards as Remy. He was such a different character. And seeing him as an actor, I thought he was amazing.
Yeah.
But in general, I had heard Gene talk about this movie so much for like months? Is it months now? Yeah. And I was kind of like, well, you know, maybe like I need to like, go watch it. And then I finally did this past weekend. And I mean, even the way it was filmed, just from very low angles and parts and in ways that felt like you were there, it was really good at creating that feeling in an almost physical way, too. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, this film does what fiction exists to do, which is take you out of your own dumb head and put you in a situation in another body, in another brain, and show you painstakingly through the gradual, slow accretion of small, specific details that the human experience is universal, that we have the same feelings about our situation are very different, but our emotions are not. There's a long walk to a car that is just weighted down with all this unsaid stuff. And I have never had a situation like Sharon's in this movie. And, you know, the moment that follows it, nothing like that. But that moment, I've been in that space. Mm-hmm. There's a moment a little bit later in a kitchen when you can see on the actor Trevante Rhodes' face. Shout out to that guy. That's an amazing performance.
So good.
You can see.
I thought you wanted to shout at his face.
Yeah, right.
Exactly. That too.
That this moment is about to happen. This thing is about to, like, what he says in that next second is going to change his life fundamentally. Mm. You can see him pulling it back right before he says it. It's just so loaded with moments like that. It does what fiction is meant to do, and it does it beautifully and understated, and so much is left unsaid.
Oh, yeah, there's so many ellipses, like, in this movie. I mean, just the scene, there's this really important scene in the first act in which Sharon, who then is being called Little, is at the table, and he asks Mahershala Ali's character, whose name is Juan, he sits him down, and he's like, what's a faggot? And they have this conversation about sexuality. It's like a really loving conversation.
Oh,
but
my God.
He starts to say something else.
Oh,
and his girlfriend, who's played by Janelle Monáe, stops. She just shakes her head. I wanted to know what she was stopping him from saying, right? And I think I know what she was stopping him from saying, but I don't know, right? And it just, there were so many moments like that. It's like, there's a world in which these people inhabit that is not just about the scene, right?
Yeah.
Like, it felt like you were sitting in on an actual conversation that might happen.
I'm so glad you brought up
Me
that
too.
Scene. That look on her face. Mm-hmm. Like, I don't think of Janelle Monáe as an actor.
Sure,
I think
right.
of her as a performer,
right,
and an
right.
incredible performer. But this was so subdued, like the rest of the movie. This glance that she shoots him, it's so subtle. And in so many other movies like this, TV shows like this, in that scene like that, happening at the dinner table, the like, oh no, everything would have been ramped up so much more, but she shoots him like a flicker of a look, and it speaks volumes. Yeah, I loved this movie, and I think the subtlety and the quietude and also just these larger themes of who you become when you decide who you're going to become, who you're going to forgive, and how that's going to manifest itself. While I was watching the movie, I was like, huh, this is really quiet. And then later, it just kept percolating in my head, and I kept piecing together pieces of it in my head and reliving it in my head. It stuck with me for a long time, and I love this movie. I hope this movie is as embraced by audiences as it is by critics.
Yeah.
What did you guys think of the casting of this movie in terms of how different these three versions of Chiron are?
So much of this movie happens, as you said before, like on the faces of the characters. And there were moments in each of the acts in which, I mean, because the three actors don't look anything alike.
Right.
They're like roughly the same skin complexion, but that's it.
Yeah.
In which you could sort of see echoes of like sort of running through. In the last act, we see Trevante Rhodes, who is like a very physically different person than teenage Chiron is. And when he meets someone from his past and they're having a conversation, and when he's asked a question, you see that sort of like crack in the facade. You see something that's very similar to
very
like the vulnerable, the teenage Chiron. That kid needs to be nominated for something.
He was,
right?
He was really just good.
I wanted to hug him so badly. Just seems so vulnerable. Yeah. And then it was like heartbreaking. They don't look alike, but you see a piece of the same sort of like the same demeanor just for a couple seconds, like flickers of like when he sort of dodges a question that someone asks him directly.
Yeah, in the Trevante Rhodes performance, you definitely see the ripples and reverberations of decisions that teenage Chiron has made and just decisions of where to completely spackle over parts of him that created problems for him or that he felt created problems for him. The way each version of this character is feeding off of decisions and actions by the previous incarnation is really, really fascinating to watch. And it's so interesting to see how you get from kid Chiron to adult Chiron and the compromises and challenges that have come along the way. Oh, I love this movie.
The one thing, and it's a really, 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 really minor critique. Naomi Harris plays Chiron's mother, and she's a drug addict. And so this is one of the things that Chiron is sort of navigating. she was actorly, right? Mm-hmm. And so there were some notes that felt less sort of naturalistic. The rest of the movie, honestly, like there were parts of it, except for the fact that it was like beautifully shot, there were parts of it that almost felt like documentary. And there were parts in which she just seemed almost like too big for the moment. Like there were only two or three times when I felt that, but I felt it so much because the rest of the movie felt so natural that I think in another movie I wouldn't have noticed that at all.
She's forced to serve as a little bit of shorthand, I think, in ways that don't necessarily serve her well.
Yeah, I mean, this film feels natural and documentary-like, but it also feels like a story that hasn't been told a million times. Mm-hmm. I'm not using this as an excuse, Stephen, to dump on Boyhood again.
I knew Boyhood was going to come up.
But I mean, here it is. This is a story we haven't seen before millions and millions of times. And I, you know, I railed against the coming of age story because it seems like as a culture, we tell ourselves only the one coming of age story. Right. And as logistically brilliant and unmatched as Boyhood is, what it came away with for me felt familiar. The only elements of this story that felt at all familiar is the stuff with the mom. Mm-hmm. We've seen pieces of that elsewhere. We just haven't seen this adoption of a persona as a way to get through life in quite this way. And, you know, this thing affected me in small ways, like Juan is teaching Little how to swim.
That
scene is just so filled with all these little moments. And this thing that Juan says seemed ad-libbed, and I'm sure it wasn't written. Might have been, I don't know, but he just says, "more athletic." And it's like, oof, oh, jeez,
right.
That I recall something very like that. The scene where the teenage Chiron performs an act that propels him into the third act of the film. I was holding a little plastic cup, a little tumbler, and it cracked. So is this film working on me? I guess it is. There's going to be a backlash against it because it is huge. It is as praised, universally praised as it is. It's going to be dinged as sentimental, which I've already seen it started to be, and I don't buy that.
I don't think it is.
I am the biggest guard against sentimentality as you'll find. And this felt everything about it. Again, even the moments with the mom felt real, they didn't feel necessarily true in a weird way. Mm-hmm. So I was on guard for that. It's also going to get dinged, I think, because, you know, you can't find a gay guy to play a gay guy. You have to get a straight actor. Which, again, it seems to me like...
They actually got Tilda Swinton.
Yeah. They totally should get Tilda Swinton.
Oh.
That would have been awesome.
Oh, man.
Yeah, but that's the thing. I mean, that's okay. That's a critique, but I wouldn't want to see anybody else but Trevante Rhodes playing that particular role because he just knocked it out of the park.
I think a lot of people in the theater, when they first saw Trevante Rhodes, made reactions that made me think that they agree with you. And, you know, the important, very, very, very important backstory here is that both Barry and Terrell is the playwright who wrote In Moonlight, Black Boys Look Blue. Both Barry and Terrell are from this housing project in which the movie is set in Liberty City, Miami. And they grew up a couple blocks away from each other. Wow. They didn't know each other growing up. Terrell and Barry, both of their mothers were drug addicts. They're both addicted to crack. Terrell's mother died of HIV in the 90s. Barry's mother is HIV positive. She's still alive. We talked a little bit about that on the podcast. Barry's mom hasn't seen it, but basically like an amalgamation of both their mothers. And so it's really close to them. And there was, you know, there's a scene in which Chiron is coming home one morning, and that scene like was really hard to watch. And he meets his mother, who is like just having this like manic episode. So much of this is, again, is like not about sort of like shouty scenes even. There's another scene in the second act that sort of like was a defining moment for Chiron. Just the way this beach scene was shot was really restrained.
Yeah. Very romantic too, in a sense.
Yeah, and like really, really tense, right?
Yeah.
I mean, the diner scene, the third act was like, I was just the whole time, I'm like, oh my God.
Like, I need a fan here.
It's just stakes. Mm-hmm. You just feel the stakes in all of those pivotal scenes. Like, this could go a lot of different ways. Mm-hmm. The range of outcomes is incredibly wide.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Even the ending, which I've seen a bunch of really thoughtful pieces about, like, one of the last shots in the movie, about, like, what sort of being let down by what happens there. But I thought that was, like, in keeping with the spirit of the rest of the movie and that it was, like, really restrained and you don't get this thing. And the main character...
And, like, the character himself,
is,
too, very restrained.
Very restrained and very sort of, like, unrealized hope. You know, like, I mean, he just couldn't have it. I think that was a really great choice.
So good.
Yeah, we're gushing.
All right, so... This is where I say, if you have thoughts on Moonlight, go to facebook.com/PCHH. Give us your thoughts. Hopefully, if you're in a big enough city, you probably have a way of seeing this movie. See the movie.
Yeah, please do.
When we come back, it will be time for our favorite segment of this and every week, What is Making Us Happy? So stick around.
Support for this podcast comes from the new original comedy Search Party on TBS. Here's John Early describing his character, Elliot.
Elliot is a self-made man just very much of this kind of multi-hyphenate generation, which is so true to so many people I know, of just like actor, producer, event planner. You know, he does everything, which means he kind of does nothing.
You can binge the entire season of Search Party in 1 week, starting Monday, November 21st at 11, 10 Central on TBS.
It's time once again for our favorite segment, What is Making Us Happy This Week? Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week, buddy?
We've talked about the FX show Atlanta a bit on the show. It just had its season finale, a great episode called The Jacket. For a show that is as formally inventive as that show has been, it ended with a very quiet, almost familiarly structured episode. But what I want to really shout out is the performance that I don't think has gotten the attention it should have by Brian Tyree Henry, who plays Paperboy, the rapper on the show.
Yes.
That show is good, but it's not often laugh-out-loud funny.
Sure.
And anytime it is, you can bet that it has something to do with Brian Tyree Henry. His expressions, his reactions, in a larger sense, are what just keep me coming back to this show. Everything does. Everything about the show keeps me coming back to it. But there is a special joy in that performance, which is so nuanced and so layered. And just often, when you think you're going down one path, you get knocked into this other path, all because of how he reacts to something. Yeah. So Brian Tyree Henry on Atlanta, great stuff.
Yeah, that's such a good show. Thank you, Glenn. Great pick. Kat Chow, what's making you happy this week?
What's making me happy is I just finished up this awesome book called The Wings Versus the World by an author named Jade Chang. I see Jessica Reedy lighting up. and it's
Lighting up with enjoyment, not lighting up.
With enjoyment, not fury. And this book is so funny. So it's fiction, and it's kind of in that genre of like crazy rich Asians, like that Kevin Kwan novel. But instead of being set in Asia or some Asian country, this is sort of like a immigrant story in the U.S., but instead of idealizing the home country, it goes in a completely different direction. And I really enjoyed it. The writing is sharp. The characters are very nicely developed, and it goes by quickly. So if you're looking for something to kind of get you through the end of election week, then I really recommend it. And it feels, I think they're going to make this into a movie. It feels very sort of cinematic in the way it's written. The title is The Wings Versus the World by Jade Chang.
Great. Thank you, Kat Chow. Gene Demby, what's making you happy this week?
I am going to steal from Glenn and do two. I know he usually has like an omnibus happy. So the first one actually is, since we're talking about Barry Jenkins, his first movie, Medicine for Melancholy, was a favorite of mine for a long time. It came out in 2008. It was funny because Moonlight is like, it hit me in a bunch of places. But so did Medicine for Melancholy. It's a story about, very much like Before Sunset, it's a people who meet cute, and actually not that cute, Wyatt Cenac and an actress named Treese Higgins, are sort of thrown into the situation where they spend a weekend together, sort of getting to know each other. They are black people who live in San Francisco, which is like the least black of the... statistically, the least black of like the, I think, the 25 largest American metro areas. Huh. And so much of their fraught quasi-courtship over the 2 days is informed by the fact that like we might be the only people who might like roll in these circles. And I was 27 when it came out. It was right where I lived in a lot of ways. And so if you haven't seen it, it's on Netflix. The other thing I wanted to shout out was this documentary. I don't know what you would call it, actually. It's called Camera Person. It's by this woman named Kirsten Johnson. She's a documentary filmmaker, and it's a collection of like footage that she's shot over decades of doing her job. And it is mesmerizing. At first, you're like, what the hell is going on? Like, the first shots are just sort of, like, established. Like, her sort of setting up her cameras, like, on the side of a road. And, like, there's sheep walking by. She's somewhere. And then it starts to slowly sort of, like, zoom into the stories of the people that she's shooting. And you get the sense, you start to feel some of her ambivalence about sort of being on the edges of some of these really terrible stories in a lot of cases. And not being able to do anything. But also sort of, like, you just get wrapped up in the stories, but it jumps around. It's sort of a collage. So you're never in one place for too long, even though she sort of circles back to them. And so you start to see these themes emerging. I mean, it's a riveting movie. If you can see it in a theater, I think you should see it in a movie theater because it needs to be seen on a giant screen. A full-throated endorsement of a Camera Person.
Great. Thank you so much, Gene Demby. In the spirit of of both of you guys, I brought two things. We are now in November, and November is known for a lot of highly anticipated entertainment. Mm-hmm. This tends to be more the case in things like movies than it is in things like music, where typically in November, December, into early January, the release schedule slows down quite quite a bit. And you get like a few kind of big mainstream music releases that are designed to sell on Black Friday. And hip hop tends not to dry up completely in that time of year, which I guess is maybe why these two albums I'm so incredibly excited about are still coming out in 2016. And I cannot wait. One, after 18 years, there is a new Tribe Called Quest album coming out the day that this episode drops. They are also going to be on Saturday Night Live.
Yeah, oh my gosh.
The day after this episode drops. I'm in the tank for Ali Shaheed Muhammad because of his work on Microphone Check for NPR, and also, of course, his actual career.
Yeah.
In addition to this, as fans or even kind of casual fans of the band know, Fife Dog, one of its members, died earlier this year. And that seems to have sort of inspired these guys to get back together and make what is being billed as like, this is it. This is our last record. It's called We Got It From Here. Thank You For Your Service. And very little from this record has trickled out. So there's always a possibility that I could be incredibly disappointed by it. But I'm so excited that it exists. I mean, this has been happening in so many other genres of music where these bands will reunite after 17 years. Oh, there's a new My Bloody Valentine record for the first time in 20 years. Enjoy. But to see it happen with this band, which was just such an incredibly key band in my heady early 90s college radio days, I'm so ready for it. Speaking of things I'm so ready for, cannot let an episode of Pop Culture Happy Hour go by without expressing my excitement about the Hamilton mixtape. For those who have not already flipped out about it, which I'm talking about 15% of our audience here, the track listing alone is making me happy. It's these kind of re-envisionings of the songs on the Hamilton Cast album. The two that they have put out as of this taping are My Shot, the Rise Up remix by The Roots featuring Busta Rhymes. Oh my God. Family rushing and wonder if Busta been feeling the hunger and feeding the lust to win. Lust to win. See, I've been patiently waiting for this moment to rise up again. It's the way I was molded, and it's the last one standing as the rest of them folded. Give me my one chance to grab the torch and properly hold it. I said I'm not throwing away my shot. I said I'm not throwing away. And the, oh my God, It's Quiet Uptown, which on the Hamilton Cast album makes me blubber like a baby, performed by Kelly Clarkson. But I'm not afraid. I know who I'm marrying. Just let me stay here by your side, and that would be enough. And this performance has gotten like these wonderful kind of critical notices for Kelly Clarkson, who I've always thought was criminally underrated. Looking at this track listing, it also has all these Easter eggs in terms of outtakes. Probably the one I'm most excited about. A few months ago, Linda referenced Congratulations, which is this great Angelica Schuyler takedown of Alexander Hamilton. As Linda has said many times about Hamilton, she wishes the Angelica character were fleshed out a little bit more and given a little
bit. I think everyone feels that way.
Like that there's clearly, it feels like she has a song missing. That song is Congratulations. Absolutely. It's performed on the Hamilton mixtape by Dessa, who is a singer and rapper who I absolutely love, and I'm so hoping that this like turns more people onto her. I have not heard it yet, but I can't wait. I love having great music to look forward to at the end of the year when people who write about music are spending so much time starting to prep like their year-end coverage. Getting surprised with new music that excites you is a treat.
If you like Hamilton, by the way, I'm just going to shout out the Code Switch podcast one more time and do some log rolling. You should holler at Code Switch next Wednesday. We'll have a treat for you, let's say.
Cannot wait to hear that. All right, and that brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Happy Hour this week, you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow the show at PCHH. You can follow me at I Dislike Steven. That's Steven with a PH. You can follow Glenn Weldon at GH Weldon. And you can follow Kat Chow at Kat Chow. That's KATCHOW. And of course, you can follow our pal Gene Demby at GD215. That's GEEDEE215. You can follow our producer Jessica Reedy at Jessica_Reedy. And you can follow our producer emeritus and music director Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's KATZIF. Mike's band, Hello Come In, provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to now. So thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening, and we will see you right back here next week.
Are you a music nerd or a fledgling music nerd who wants to know more about what's out there? The All Songs Considered podcast from NPR Music is here to help. All Songs Considered is NPR's music discussion and discovery podcast. Bob Boylan and Robin Hilton share the best new and upcoming music, including an extended conversation with Justin Vernon, frontman of Bon Iver. Find songs you'll fall in love with on All Songs Considered every Tuesday on the NPR One app and at npr.org/podcasts.